Blog Talk Radio.
All right, folks. We have been waiting for tonight for at least a week now. This interview that we have scheduled for tonight has been something that has kind of been in the works. It's something I've been trying to do for quite some time, and I haven't ever been able to find someone who was willing to come on and just have an open discussion with a what we're calling a moderate Muslim. And I don't even know if this is a politically correct association of a description, but tonight we have David Liu, and help me with your last name.
Is Walalu? Walalu.
Walalu. There you go.
There we go.
That is a wonderful last name, and it does not is not pronounced the way it looks in writing. But very excited to have him on our program. I have been promoting this show, like I said, for the past week. A little bit of background on who David is. David served served in the U.S. Army Intelligence Corps and was also an international security analyst. He holds a Ph.D. in public policy with a focus on homeland and international security. He's also an instructor at McLennan Community College, and we're very excited to have him on tonight. Thank you for joining us, David.
You're welcome. My pleasure, sir.
Well, like our mutual friend, Bill Whitaker, he mentioned to me, and really because of him, this came together. He's known of my desire to speak to someone, mainly someone who has a more moderate position on in the realm of the Muslim world, and it seems like we don't ever hear that voice. All we hear is the extremist, the terrorist. We hear and we watch videos of people yelling death to America, and really we are creating an image that unfortunately is being attached to all Muslims. Tell the listeners a little bit about your background, and then I want to get right into this, whether there is such a thing as moderate Muslims.
Sure. Well, first of all, I am so grateful for the opportunity, and I thank you for providing this kind of platform, which is much needed for engaging into this civilized and honest discussion about these issues of the relationship between the Muslims in the U.S. and even the thinking of how Muslims are perceived in the U.S. and vice versa. But before we get into this, let me just give a brief background as to where I came from, where I was born, and so forth, which will provide the listeners an idea as to how I can relate to explaining a little bit about how Islam is perceived. I was born in Morocco, and I lived there almost for 18 to 20 years before my parents passed away, and I left the country for good. As a matter of fact, I only returned last year after 26 years being here in the U.S. Even though I was born in Morocco, my family, some members of my family, close ones to me, live in France, Germany, Holland, London. They are more of a European mindset. And my ancestors traced their race to Spain, in an area in Sevilla. And if you, the listeners, I'm sure they will understand, during the conquest era back in the 16th century, they fled from the Andalusia or Sevilla area into northern Morocco. As far as my last name, well, it is very hard. I was known inside the government as David O. It was easy for everybody to pronounce my name that way. That's a Hawaiian name. And to my surprise, I was very, very shocked to learn how my name is belonged to a tribe in Maui. I was born in Morocco, and yet the name is attached to Hawaii. I kind of like never knew that. The joke was with me back then in D.C. when I used to work in D.C. that Okay, you were born in Morocco, in Africa. Your family lives in Europe. You work in Washington, and you live in Waco. How this could be? So that's usually my background. I trace back my time to the U.S. back in 1990. That's when I came to the U.S. And I only came to the U.S., believe it or not, to only exchange my visa status to go back to Canada because I was accepted at the University of Quebec at Montreal. But for some odd reason, the custom agents didn't grant me the return visa. So I was stuck in America. And so I worked through the protocol for the immigration process and so forth till the rest is history now. It is 27 years later. And I am so glad it happened, Bowie. I won't trade it for the world.
Mm. Well, let's get into this conversation. You know, we've only got 25 minutes left in this program, and I'm thinking we're going to have to create a series here. But, you know, all we hear are the terms Muslims, extremists, terrorists, et cetera, et cetera. Are you a moderate Muslim? Is there such a thing?
Yeah. I do believe there is something as a moderate Muslim. I am one. I consider myself a moderate Muslim. And the idea of being in the U.S., first of all, for this issue of immigrants, and let's focus on the ones coming from the Muslim world. The decision has to be made within the person before he or she makes the decision to immigrate to the U.S. In my case, I made the decision that should I end up in the U.S., should I decide to live in the U.S., I will have to embrace the values of the country, my adopted country. It's because that's where I will belong. That's the country I will defend. That the country I will work. That the country I will eat and sleep and have my family and so forth. It becomes home to the point that I remember back in 1992 or 3, a good friend of mine who resides now in Canada asked me a question. And I said, he said, what would you do if a war breaks out between Morocco and the United States? Who would you bear arms for? I said, I would bear it for the United States because this is home to me now. But just because I was born in one country does not mean this is it. No, this is my home now. This is where I belong. And the idea of being a moderate Muslim, of course, with the traditions you were raised with, those are principles, values that you grew up with. You're going to maintain those, of course. Where the issue is to find a balance between the values in your home and the values you were raised with. And that's where some Muslims have a hard time finding that balance. You cannot be in a new culture and you don't assimilate. You cannot be in a new culture and you don't learn the language. You cannot be in a new culture and acquire the values of that new culture. It does not mean you have to embrace it, but at the same time, you have to respect what those values of that culture is, because now you consider yourself a member of that society. And if you don't like it, then you pack your bags and head it back home.
Well, but that's not what CARE does. You know, they actually want us to change our laws to accommodate the Muslim faith. It seems like, you know, there's certain requirements according to the Quran, as far as, mm-hmm. for example, women, the way women dress.
Okay.
You know, the whole concept of the Sharia law versus American law, this, like you say, we want people here to assimilate into our way of life. I don't have a problem with the guy next door not having the same religion or not believing the same as I do. As long as, like you say, we share the same values of this country. When we don't, I really do question the loyalty to the country. And is that wrong for me to question, or is that natural for us to start? You know, is it just the media creating this spin, or is there some validity? Obviously, I don't see Christians I don't see Jews, you know, creating all this havoc. It's all Muslim.
Yeah, I see your point. And it is within your right to question certain practices that they completely go against our values here in America. Take, for example, this the women dress, which, by the way, as a Muslim, I do not subscribe to that. My wife is a Christian. She's an American, but she's a Canadian of descent. And I never felt comfortable with that kind of cover and all that. Here is why. Because in Islam itself, in the Quran, did not describe that a woman has to cover head to toe. When I served in the U.S. Military, or when I was involved in projects for the United States government in Afghanistan, I used to go downtown Kabul and see women cover head to toe, and I shake my head because I said to myself, this is not Islam. Islam never said that the women should not be allowed to be outside. Islam never said that the women cannot be a doctor. Islam never said that the women cannot be a professor. Where is this interpretation coming from? Where is this twisting in religion? Because this never happened, at least in my understanding or the way I was raised. And my mom never covered head to toe, and yes, she was a Muslim. And when I started to see that kind of approach to the twisting of the religion itself, the interpretation, and of course with understanding the justifications for it, there had to be some forces from the Middle East that pushing certain ideological and religious agenda in form of, oh, women's role is at home, she has to stay at home, period. And there is nothing in the Quran that justifies that. Of course, we're going to question that here in the U.S. because we don't live like this. Will I force my way on my wife to dress head to toe? No, I won't. And I refuse to do that. I am a Muslim. She's a Christian. And we are fine with that. It's because this kind of interpretations, it's only validated by certain extremist views that are funded by some sources in the Middle East. And we will get to that down the road as we discuss. The other issue of the Sharia law, there is a misconception here, and I will have to say that the media kind of exaggerates the term itself. When we talk about the Sharia law, we're not talking about the guidelines by which women have to behave this, a man has to behave this way, and so forth. What are we talking about is the parameters under which a person can conduct his life or her life. Stated differently, there is since the concept of a separation between church and state, and in the Islamic tradition, it will be a separation between the mosque and the government, does not exist like we have here. So, politics and religion are intertwined in the Muslim world, not in all countries. I'm going to give you a best example again. Take Morocco, for example, where I was born, and take Saudi Arabia. Both of them Muslim countries, both of them approach religion differently, completely differently. Both of them are monarchies, both of them have a different interpretation of Islam. One of them is far right, which is under the Wahhabism ideology. One of them is a Sunni Maliki, which is a more moderate. That's where I came from. So the interpretation of the Sharia law, when I hear in the news here that all Muslims are pushing with the Sharia law, that's nonsense. Because we have something here called the Constitution. Even for what Ben Carson mentioned more recently, that, oh, I will not support an American Muslim president. Well, wait a minute. Did you read what Article 6 said in the Constitution, that religion was not part of that? And plus, if this American president happens to be of Muslim background, he is abide or she's abide to by the law of the land, which is the Constitution. Sharia law or religious matters, what have you, stays aside. That's your private life. You're going to conduct your business according to the laws of the land, period.
Well, I've got a couple. One question I'm going to ask, and then we've got to take a hard break here. You're saying things basically that there are leaders within the religion of Islam who are twisting the Quran, twisting the scriptures, and they're convincing people to follow this new version. Those people are the ones that are chanting death to America, death to Israel, etc. Would those people consider you to be an enemy?
In their eyes, I might be, because I don't conform to their best of thinking, because I don't believe in it. I live in America because of my choice. No one forced me to live in the U.S. It was my choice to live here, my choice to adopt the values of this country, and yet I am still Muslim. I still have that freedom of religion because the whole country was based on it. Yes, those individuals in, let's say, Middle East, for example, will perceive me as the enemy. Well, be it, because I will challenge them in explaining to me where does it say in the Quran that I have to conform to what Islam said. Whatever goes between me and God, however you perceive that to be, that's between me and God. Who are you as an individual, and I'm talking from the perspective of those in the Middle East, to judge me? Since when we get into the business of judging people? Leave it to the Creator. He is the one to judge everybody, because He will judge everybody according to this scripture. And yes, I will be perceived as the enemy. But guess what? I am comfortable with the way I live here. I assimilated into society. I practice religion. I respect the Constitution. I respect the laws of the land. I served in the U.S. military. This is my home. This is my country. And if they perceive it that way...
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back,
okay,
we're talking Saudi Arabia. I know you wrote an article about their influence in this war, this terrorism, and all these tactics that we're talking about. So don't go away, folks. We'll be right back.
One disease. Millions of lives permanently disrupted. Today, there are over 5 million Americans living with Alzheimer's disease. But Alzheimer's is taking more than memories. It's taking lives. What few realize is that Alzheimer's kills more people than breast cancer and prostate cancer combined. And Alzheimer's is the only disease in the top 10 causes of death that can't be slowed, stopped, or prevented. From 2000 to 2013, while deaths from other diseases decreased significantly, Alzheimer's deaths increased 71%. But equally disturbing, many living with Alzheimer's say they are not being told their diagnosis. While more than 90% of people with the most common types of cancer say they are told their diagnosis, only 45% of people with Alzheimer's or their caregivers say they are told. The economic toll is staggering too. In 2015, it will cost the nation $226 billion to care for people with Alzheimer's. By 2030, 72 million baby boomers will reach an age of greater risk. The fact is, everyone's at risk for Alzheimer's, even you. But everyone can help, especially you. We're the Alzheimer's Association, the brains behind saving yours. Join us.
All right, we're back. That was a great first segment, and we are talking with David Walalu. I think I said that correctly. you know, I was reading your articles, and I see that you are on the board of contributors at the Waco Tribune Herald, and one of your articles really was a wake-up call, it seemed, to draw attention to Saudi Arabia. It seems like they're being ignored. Everyone's talking about Iran and Syria, but you draw attention to the fact that Saudi Arabia is truly maybe the root of all of this, all of these troubles, because they're the big backer. They provide the financial support. Why don't you let us know what your thoughts are there?
So you are talking about the article that was published on September 6th, I believe, at the Waco trip. That has to do
with that is correct. September 6th, yes.
That is correct. Well, why I decided to write on that issue, because I noticed that most of the political bandits in Washington, D.C. are addressing the nuclear issue, and the focus is on Iran, while the tensions between the Saudis and the Iranians have nothing to do with nuclear stuff. It has to do with the religious dominance. Because this our friendly allies, the Saudis, are so nervous about losing their leadership in the Muslim world, because that's the only currency they have, basically. And it strikes me as sort of interesting that nobody's talking about where the big elephant in the room is. That's the funding coming out of Saudi Arabia. And if you recall, I am sure most of your listeners got an idea about the WikiLeaks documents that have leaked a couple months, a year ago or so. And one of the documents was a memo signed by former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, in which it indicated that, I'm going to quote here the Secretary when she mentioned that, and I quote here, "More needs to be done since Saudi Arabia remains a critical financial support base for Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, the Lashkar-e-Tayyaba, which is a group in Pakistan, and other terrorist groups." The question becomes to me, why aren't we addressing this? Is it because of political convenience or political ignorance? Is Washington decide, oh, because these are our allies, Saudi allies, we can sort of turn a blind eye on them and let them do whatever, rather than addressing the real issues and see why this funding is not stopping? Why aren't we talking directly to the Saudis and say, listen, you need to stop the funding of terrorists? It's because, in my judgment, Saudis may be thinking in terms of, if we keep funding the terrorism, hey, we'll keep America away from us as far as not focusing on what we're doing. And to me, that's problematic, because Americans need to understand the source of where this issue is coming from. It's almost like what's going on right now with ISIS. You're telling me that the U.S., the strength we have, the military capabilities, we couldn't control a group like that? And where the ISIS getting their weapons from? Somebody has to fund the group somewhere. And when we try to start to alter intelligence reports, justify intelligence reports, alter the realities and the facts to justify whatever political action, that's doing us harm. We need to address the problems head on. We need to confront the Saudis on these issues of funding terrorism, because that's, to me, part of where the source of the problem is.
Well, I mean, that sounds great, but these people are just as bad as anyone else. I mean, they're pretty ruthless, from what I understand. You're not just going to go up to the king over there and say, hey, you know, President Obama's not going to go over there and look him in the eye. I don't even think he could do that, and make any sort of demands to stop. We're going to impose sanctions.
Right.
You know, I don't know. I mean, so what do we do?
No, you're absolutely right. Our president won't be able to say that, because there are interest groups far powerful than the president of the United States who can do that. There are a lot of billions of dollars at stake. And I am sure you are aware of, when our unemployment goes up, all the Saudis need to do is write check for $60 billion and purchase weapon, and unemployment goes down. Basically, they control our markets through their petrodollars. That's the bottom line to it. Yeah, how do we do it? It's till we have determination, till we are willing to confront the issues, till the American people are informed about the issues, for us to communicate that to our policymakers, that, hey, we're not going to tolerate this anymore. It's because, after all, the concept we have that the whole country, the government, is for the people, by the people. Policymakers are there to represent us. They are working for us. We are the one who put them there in their positions to serve us, the whole population. So, but if we are uninformed about the issues, of course, policymakers are not going to do anything. And yes, I agree with you. It's not an easy solution to these problems. Till we make a decision to stop our dependency on foreign oil, especially the ones from Saudi Arabia, then we'll be sort of thinking in terms, okay, how are we going to approach this? It's because, I tell you this, at least the ones that I know, the Muslims that I know in this country, they love this country as much as any other American. And we are as upset and angry about what's going on with the Muslim world in terms of ruining the image of Islam that has nothing to do with killing innocent people. And just, there is no reason for that. But at the same time, if you don't address the real issue, which is the funding of terrorism that coming from a particular entity in the Muslim world, nothing is going to change. And that is, it's sad. It's sad to know.
Well, let me ask you this, and then I'll ask you to give a final statement. To those people who have been creating an image in their mind that Muslims in America can't be trusted, that they're not loyal to the country, that there's no such thing as a moderate Muslim. Mm-hmm. How do you get them to begin to see that they are out there, that they do love this country?
Well, first of all, it will be a show like yours, because I hardly ever seen on TV that either Fox News or CNN or whatever invited a moderate, or even other talk shows invited a moderate Muslim. They will invite the individuals who are prominently known per se, but those are not representatives of the Muslim population. This, whatever their agenda might be, that's, you know, I don't buy into that. It's a show like this to me. That's where the real conversation is, unscripted, away from sugarcoating the narrative per se, and just put the issues on the table and face them head on. As we always say, to solve the problems, the first thing you need to do is to identify what the problems are. And I think you should, at least in my judgment, it provides that kind of a forum and platform from which a discussion can move forward. A better understanding will emerge, and an intellectual conversation to bridge that gap of misunderstanding to why there is this mistrust and so forth. As far as the concept of whether moderate Muslims are mistrusted, whatever, I never felt that. And I held some position within the government that requires some classification without going into the details here, that I never felt that I've been looked at differently just because of my religion or so forth. I was respected like any other American. You do your job, you do your duties, you give 110%. And when I made that decision to bear arms for the U.S., that's the reason for it.
Well, I tell you, we've only got a minute left, and I do appreciate you coming on the program and, like you said, just speaking freely. I think we should do this again. I'm pretty sure the listeners are going to want a lot more, want to hear a lot more of what you have to say. Folks, I ask you to find me on Facebook, The Duke Machado Show, and over on Twitter, you can follow me at DukeMachado1. Every weeknight, Monday through Friday, pretty simple, 10 p.m. Central Standard Time, you can tune in and catch us. We will be posting some new shows with getting David back on, I can assure you. Again, sir, appreciate you calling in.
My pleasure. It's been a pleasure being here.
All right. You take care, and we are out of here. My name is Duke Machado, and we'll talk to you tomorrow night.